Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. I'm Ann Clark, a member of the Commonwealth Club and chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. Our program is also sponsored by the Business and Leadership Member-Led Forum, Kevin O'Malley, chair. Our program tonight is No Child Left Inside. It is a pleasure to introduce our moderator tonight, Mitch Thomashow, who's going to introduce you to our wonderful panel. Mitch is President Emeritus of Unity College and Director of the Presidential Fellows Program, Second Nature. And now Mitch will introduce you to our panel. Mitch?
Thank you very much. And first, thank you to the audience for coming tonight. It's delightful to see you all taking the time on a beautiful evening to be with us. It's always reassuring and exciting to see folks who care about these kinds of issues and who want to think more deeply about them. This is an amazing panel of people. They represent a great variety of experience, a great depth of experience, and a lot of history in this field. Interestingly, when I saw who the panelists were, they were chosen by Orion Magazine, where I'm on the board, I realized that I knew each one of them, but I hadn't seen any of them for between 15 and 35 years. So it's a wonderful reunion, but it also gives you a sense of the depth of history that's here and the fact that we've got folks who have been involved in this field really for their whole lives. It's so deeply ingrained in who they are, their identity, their professional and their personal work, and I have great admiration for all of them. Zenobia Barlow is at the center of eco-literacy. She will tell you more about her work in a moment. Loretta Rogers is at Point Blue Conservation, and she works on creek restoration, stream restoration. Running Grass works at Three Circles, an organization which he founded. And actually, Running Grass and I go way, way back, our days at Antioch, New England, way back in the late 70s. And Nicole Arduin is at Stanford University, where she is on the faculty. So you've got some very, very interesting people, and I'm delighted to see you all. Here's what we're going to do. They're going to each speak for about 8 to 10 minutes, because it makes sense for them to tell you about their work, build a narrative that is a narrative both of professional practice and personal transformation, and for you to get a sense of where they're located in space and time in terms of their work. And it's also easier, of course, for you radio listeners out there to listen to one person speak for a while. Then I'm going to ask the panelists to see if they have any questions that they would like to ask each other, or if there's any that I would like to ask them, and then we will open it up to all of you so we get some of your thoughts and your questions. There's a protocol for that, which involves writing your questions down on a card, and we'll move forward. And that's our plan for the next hour. So, Zenobia, we're delighted to start with you.
Thank you. Well, I wanted to start with a couple of stories so that we'd have a shared context for looking into No Child Left Inside. And the first story is from a meeting and a conversation that I had recently with some college students. They were from one of the nation's top-ranked universities, and they had organized a student-led course around food systems. So they called and asked if they could meet with me to learn a little more about the work we've been doing over the last couple of decades. Most recently, we've been involved in a partnership with the Education Division of National Geographic, and they asked us to provide educational materials aligned with the new academic standards for their 2014 theme, The Future of Food. We're also engaged in a statewide effort called California Food for California Kids, and we're continuing a five-year partnership with the Oakland Schools, Rethinking School Lunch Oakland, to create a new central kitchen, instructional farm, and education center. So on the day of their visit, the 15 college students crowded into the glass meeting room in our headquarters in the David Brower Center in downtown Berkeley. And when I asked them what was interesting to them, they just erupted with these questions. It took me a few minutes to figure out what it was they were asking, because it was so different than what I expected. So these were kids who were the nation's brightest young minds. Their K-12 backgrounds were in the wake of No Child Left Behind, the very well-intentioned reform legislation passed in 2001 that No Child Left Inside is riffing on. What the students asked me was to adjudicate the exact single right answer to the question of what is the effective strategy for transforming food systems. I was like, what? They wanted to know, was it correct to work on public policy at the national or international level, or they should be working locally? They wanted to know if it was correct to combine a working farm with an education center, or whether those should be in isolation. These students had all these shoulds. They would tie themselves into knots, and they were really unable to analyze the very issue that had motivated them to organize the class in the first place. So my fear is that the impoverished learning environment of the classroom, even in affluent environments, when coupled with the standardized testing in No Child Left Behind, could be dumbing down even the brightest of young people. So as reform legislation for education, No Child Left Behind was based on the premise that setting high standards and establishing measurable goals would improve individual outcomes in education. Sounds simple, sounds straightforward, sounds reasonable. But in practice, the unintended consequence, in my humble opinion, is that standardized testing created and then reinforced the false assumption that there is actually a single right answer. The students in the room had mastered the logical fallacy of false dichotomies, and in the process were ill-equipped for thinking complexly in terms of systems, which encourages nimble ability to move between multiple levels of scale. So I've done a lot of thinking, reflecting on this experience with these college students. And one of my assumptions is that if their educational backgrounds had included more of an immersion in the dynamic complexity of the natural world, like in gardening or habitat restoration, they would be much more capable of addressing the challenges of our time. So here's a contrasting story. In the early days of the Center for Eco-Literacy, and we were founded in 1995, we scouted for and convened a network of diverse K-12 school communities. We searched in urban and rural and suburban settings in Northern California, and we convened monthly sessions in Northern California. All of the people in the network had organized their curriculum and the community in their schools around an environmental project. And our network included Brookside School, which is how I know Lorette, out of which emerged the Straw Project, Students and Teachers Restoring a Watershed, the Edible Schoolyard from King Middle School in Berkeley, and also Tule Elk Park, which is a beautiful little school with a big vision, which ripped up 20,000 square feet of asphalt to create an environmental park on their school grounds. So here's the story. The Center for Eco-Literacy provided day-long seminars for the teachers at Tule Elk, and I have really vivid memories. This is a long time ago, maybe 20 years ago, of a session we designed around the pedagogy of place. And so the point we were making is that the place itself, even if it's only where chamomile is growing out of the cracks in a sidewalk, is a rich context for teaching and learning. So during the seminar, the teachers created this little three-dimensional model of their school, and they created all the places around with these little handmade boxes. And I remember one that said pet store and another one that said the post office. And afterwards, the teachers took the children on walking tours of their neighborhood, and they corresponded with the people in the post office, and they corresponded with the people in the pet store, and they just made their neighborhood a place of lively interaction. So I remember this one teacher, Miguel, an immigrant from Mexico, who was a really gifted teacher. His first grade classroom was in a bungalow with a back door that opened out into a courtyard with a garden and a big, beautiful tree with a canopy. Miguel taught the children to stand very quietly and to observe the life in the garden. Late one afternoon, a brightly colored fluttering bird landed on the outstretched hand of a child and stayed there for a very long moment. the children really experience themselves as being part of the natural world. Now, the kids in the adjoining courtyard were squealing and shouting and throwing gravel at the birds. So, you know, these are skills we need to encourage in young people, this sense of being part of something, of being a subject in the world, not just an object in an adversarial relationship with other objects. David Orr, the Oberlin environmental educator who serves on our board, wrote that, in quotes, a revolution in education is underway, and it's starting in the most unlikely of places. The revolutionaries are not professional educators from a famous university. Rather, they are elementary school students, a growing number of intrepid teachers, and a handful of facilitators from widely diverse backgrounds. The goal of the revolution is the reconnection of young people with their own habitats and communities. So this, for me, is the essential definition of no child left inside, a fundamental reconnection of young people and their education with their own places and their own communities. So at the Center for Ecoliteracy, we've developed four program principles, and they are articulated by our senior editor in his book, Smart by Nature. And one of them is that the real world is the optimal learning environment. So in short, at the center, we advance ecological education through the experience and the understanding of how nature sustains lives. We were asked to talk about, what's the challenge that we face in advancing this kind of education? So I want to say that the default setting in education is not enriched learning in the natural world. Institutions of education don't tend to make time or space for real-world learning environments. So carving out time and space requires leadership and persistence. Between bell schedules, which break up the day into tight little spaces, and this notion of seat time, which is how curriculum minutes are measured, it's challenging to create the kind of spaciousness that's necessary. Transportation alone, one of the many reasons that I admire Lorette and the students and teachers restoring a program, which restoring a watershed project that you're going to hear about in a minute, is that she and her colleagues just persisted against all kinds of obstacles in facing the liabilities of taking children out into restoring a habitat, transportation, order. It just takes this persistence and this capacity, but this kind of education holds great promise both in meaning and relevance. And, kids are dropping out of school out of a sense that, what's the point of all of this? How does it relate to me? So we were also asked to address, how does this kind of learning inform layers of schooling and priorities? Our strategy is always to find out what's going on in schools, because it's kind of like fashion. It's like trends and changes, and teachers have whatever is the new set of standards imposed on them. So in order to penetrate the system of the school, it's helpful to know what's the problem they're trying to solve and to align with it. So the project that we're just working on now with National Geographic Education is to align the themes of food, culture, health, and the environment with the new Common Core standards and the new Next Generation Science standards. And in Oakland, we're working with them to develop a teaching facility that will provide hands-on opportunities for students and also address career pathways and meaningful high school reform. So then another question we've asked to address is, so what does all this have to do with sustainability, multicultural perspectives, urban issues, social justice, and economic equity? So I'm very happy to share with you that in Oakland, we have been partnering with the school district for about 5 years in a program and a change process that incorporates environmental learning, multicultural perspectives, urban issues, social and food justice, and economic equity. Oakland is a district of nearly 40,000 students, 70% of whom are eligible for participating in free or reduced price meals. Many students, especially in the early grades, are eating as many as 5 meals a day, breakfast, snacks, lunch, snacks, and a hot supper at school, including the expanded learning day and after school, which many of the children in Oakland participate. So between zip codes in Oakland, like that are less than 3 miles apart, there's as much as a 10-year discrepancy in life expectancy. So if you're a child born in West Oakland, you might live 10 years less than a child born in North Oakland. So what do you do about that? And the school district has dedicated itself to being a full-service community school and was very responsive to a process of transforming the school meals through a process called Rethinking School Lunch Oakland. And we did a feasibility study, and we determined that actually it was feasible, but it would be expensive. So we went out for a bond measure, and the bond measure campaign was pretty much led by those of us who are interested in food and social justice. And the Oakland voters, to their credit, approved a $475 million bond measure, and $40 million of that is going to be allocated to this project. So we're going to transform facilities, and we're going to design an educational program. We'll have a 1.5-acre instructional urban farm, and we're just in the process of working with the academic authorities to design all kinds of career pathways and hands-on instructional opportunities for kids. So that's just an example of one of the ways that this kind of learning can be integrated into real schools and real places. So thank you.
For the past 21 years, I've been working on a project called STRAW, Students and Teachers Restoring a Watershed. STRAW provides teachers and students and their parents, kindergarten through high school, with watershed science education, including the opportunity to do professional quality habitat restoration. This project is part of Point Blue Conservation Science, and you should know that Point Blue is an environmental nonprofit dedicated to the conservation of birds, other wildlife, and ecosystems through research and education. The STRAW project's history, it started in my classroom, actually. Fourth graders began this project in 1993. And then one or two classes did restorations for about 6 years, and then the Center for Eco-Literacy with the Bay Institute took the program on and grew it till it had, you know, 20 classes a year working on restorations. And now, for the past 3 years, it's part of Point Blue Conservation Science, and we have about 100 classes of students working on restoration projects. We just finished our 55th restoration this year, our biggest year ever. And actually, through all these years, 21 years, we've restored 30 miles of creek habitat, and also have completed about 450 restorations. And I think we have a little trailer we're going to show so you can maybe get a picture of what this restoration looks like if Will is here. And for those of you on the radio, you'll see, or you won't see, you will hear the creek, and then you'll hear some interviews. You'll hear a little bit from me and from a student and a rancher and a teacher, and show you just a little bit about our project. This is about 2 minutes. A film by David Donenfield and Kevin White. A simple question. You can look it up if you'd like to get the whole film.
We all live in a watershed. Somewhere. Someplace. This is a story of how a sense of connection to place transformed a community. Beginning with the children. Beginning with a question.
In 1992, I was teaching fourth grade, and I showed a video on endangered species and watched my students sink lower and lower in their seats until it was done. And then one boy raised his hand and he said, "Mrs. Rogers, what can we do to help endangered species?"
It seemed like somebody's got to do something about it. What good is talking about something if you're not going to try and help?
And that's when I looked at him and I knew I couldn't say, you know, let's write letters or let's do a study, that we really needed to do something big.
Wow, that is cool. The kids can take a turn with the hoe, too.
Okay, loosen the roots a little.
All right.
In a sense, this is about nature restoration. But I think in the larger sense, this is about human restoration.
One, two, three, push.
Good. As far as I'm concerned, if I'm not teaching this way, then I don't really care to be teaching.
It just makes the earth and myself a better person and a better place.
The landscape is healthier because of the work the Straw Project does.
People will ask me, did you know how big it was going to get? And I have to tell you, yeah, I did. I didn't sleep for 2 weeks after that day.
So you want one tool in the hole at a time, right, guys?
Who would guess that a fourth grader's innocent question would galvanize a community, empower children, inspire teachers, and help restore a watershed? All in an effort to save an obscure endangered species.
So this project started because we wanted to help endangered species, and we adopted the California freshwater shrimp and found that, guess what, in ecology, everything's connected. And going deep and learning about one species, you can learn about everything. You can learn about milk prices, and you can learn about water ecology, and you can learn, just all kinds of things. And so this project really taught us a lot. And the other thing about this project that makes me laugh is just, you know, this is what happens when you don't preview a video before you show it as a teacher. So I highly recommend doing that. But so for me, No Child Left Inside, it means about, you know, connecting with the real world, with real life, and having an unmediated experience. And just all the joys that being in nature gives all of us. We've been evaluating some of the students that have done the Straw Project, and many of them say that one of the things they enjoy the most is working with each other in a team. So you know how wonderful it is to be outside and be connected to the natural world, but also to be with each other outside. They really love that. And, you know, the passion for me, too, is that I'm fourth-generation San Francisco Bay Areaan, I guess, you know, and grew up in the creeks of Marin County. And it's so gratifying to be able to work on your home and to, work on those same creeks. We've even worked on the creek that I played in when I was a little girl. So there's just so many benefits for this. And what we've seen is that engagement really soars for students when they do this kind of work. They love it. I actually just got an evaluation back today from 124 students. And they said, you know, did you like it a lot? Did you like it a little? Did you not like it? And so out of 124 students, 12% liked it a little. 88% liked it a lot. And one didn't like it. Okay, there's always going to be one, right? But, over and over again, we're seeing this. And it is kind of weird now that we're so old that some of the kids that did the project with us are bringing their kids out now. So, you know, starting to feel really old. We actually have a job opening right now for a conservation educator. And one of the kids in my class, who's 27 now, just called me yesterday and would like to go for the job. So that's kind of interesting. But we are seeing that. The stories are pretty remarkable. A student who was in my class, Megan, wrote that she just couldn't believe that they could do something so meaningful. And she wrote this. She said, "I always thought kids meant nothing. But this project showed that we really could make a difference." She said, "I always thought kids were little dots." That's really sad. She actually wrote that. And 2 years ago at 27, she emailed me, remember me? Of course I do. She said, I'm trying to find a grad school program that's as meaningful as my fourth grade experience. So we see this over and over again. I play Irish music sometimes, and the people there don't know what I do for a living. And this one woman said, you know, my daughter's entering college. She's going to major in something else. She's majoring in environmental science. I said, well, how did that happen? She did this restoration project in seventh grade. Well, guess what? It was the straw project. So we need to gather more of these stories, but they're out there. It happened to me again this year. We were at a ranch for a restoration, and this 24-year-old guy from MALT, Marin Agricultural Land Trust, he shared at the end of the circle, he said, you know, I was part of your restoration as a middle school student, and that changed the trajectory of what I did with my life. So on and on about that. You should know the restorations we do are, you know, we're a huge collaborative. Department of Fish and Game, Resource Conservation Districts, Pernusky Chatham Inc., wonderful restoration firm's been working with us 20 years. We're not just fooling around. I mean, we actually are doing professional quality restoration that then our team maintains and monitors for 3 to 5 years afterwards, so we get an incredible survival rate. But all this goes to, you know, respect, not just for the environment, making sure that we're doing a good job, not just for the ranchers, we work on ranches, but also in open space and parks. We want to do our best, but you can imagine the students, too, know that their work is the real deal and that it's going to stand the test of time, that we're going to give it our best, that those trees are going to make it, and that the birds are going to come back and make their nests there, and it gives me chills. We do know that the birds, you know, for those of you on the radio, this isn't going to work, but think of a graph with the line shooting straight up. We know that they go from, that sites go from 5 species of birds to 28 species of birds. So.
Excellent. Beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you very much for being here and for inviting me to attend and be a panelist. With my esteemed colleagues, many of whom I've known for many, 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 many years, and new colleagues also. So I appreciate that very much. My name is Running Grass, and I operate a small, what was a small nonprofit that was started in the late 1980s, the genesis of which came out of my work in environmental and outdoor education. And that nonprofit is no longer a nonprofit. By choice, it's now a very nimble consulting outfit that I still work with. But if you can imagine me coming out of graduate school, Mitch was my academic advisor, actually, all those many years ago, so our lives come back around to each other. Coming into the environmental education and outdoor education field and finally kind of accomplishing the mission of finding paid work in environmental ed and outdoor education, locating myself in the Bay Area in the early 1980s and getting right to work, working with schools and working with community centers, literally thousands of kids over in five or six Bay Area counties over the course of a decade or more, low-income children, children of color, children in schools in Oakland, for instance, in Richmond, rural schools in Napa and in Sonoma County and so on, and coming upon a really incredible discovery, and that was the traditional environmental education and outdoor education that I had been working in and teaching was not really working the way that I had thought it would work. It was a period of discovery for me. What I found was that a number of factors were involved here. One was it's hard to use Project Learning Tree when students have never seen a forest; they have no idea what a forest looks like. I don't want to criticize my colleagues that have put many, many hours into these curricula, but what I found was, in essence, was that it wasn't working, so I began to look more carefully at what the students were actually experiencing. That process of discovery led to The formation of, at the time, a nonprofit called Three Circles Center for Multicultural Environmental Education. So think about the 1980s, the influx of demographic changes that were occurring in the, in California, around the country, but in California, monumental changes in demographics. And so we were having environmental educators who were going out and working with recent immigrant kids who wouldn't speak to them in English, even though they knew English, because the educators were white. You know, I had one guy who worked with an environmental education program and would take students up to the Sierra. He came back. He was working with low-income minority students from the Central Valley. He came back from the Sierra. I said, well, how did it go? He says, I don't know. I said, what do you mean you don't know? He said, well, he wouldn't speak English to me. You know, they just spoke Spanish the entire time and had their own trip. It wasn't the trip he wanted, he expected to have. But, you know, so there was a cultural conflict there. Out of that experience and these discontinuities that educators were having with the students and with the curricula that they were using came this idea of a new form of of environmental education that we called multicultural environmental education, multicultural approaches to environmental education. And that the model that we came up with was best described in a sort of a diagram of three circles that are interconnected. And the circles were cultures, ecologies, and communities. Because we realized that as environmentalists and environmental educators, outdoor educators, we could not simply come at these new communities with an environmental agenda alone. We had to take into account the community conditions, the communities, their socioeconomics, but also their cultures and their racial backgrounds. And so by doing that, the idea was that we would be able to have more a complete picture, a complete kind of involvement with the students and with the communities. And so we looked to multicultural education as a field that needed to be brought into environmental education. We needed to connect those two dots, so to speak, between multicultural ed and environmental ed. We also look to cultural workers, people who, and organizers, community organizers who knew communities. We had to become that. We had to become multicultural educators as environmental educators. We had to become cultural workers as outdoor educators. It wasn't just happening, in the Sierra. It wasn't just happening in the watersheds and so on and so forth. It was actually happening deep in the cities and deep in the communities and deep in the diversity of people. So this was basically the foundation of the work of Three Circles and cultures, ecologies, and communities. Now, in terms of Leave No Child Inside, and I totally I have deep respect for my colleagues, and I know that they have discovered the answers of experiential, unmediated experiences in the environment, directly working with communities on the community's issues, food security. This is really the kind of environmental education that in the mid and late 1980s was not really the typical environmental ed. So we're really seeing a change, a sea change, in how environmental education is looking at itself as a field and how it's actually operating. In terms of what the concept of Leave No Child Inside means to me, I would say, first of all, that and just get it right out front here, is that I see No Child Left Inside, like I see environmental education, as primarily a social justice, or specifically an environmental justice perspective. That's where I'm coming at this from. Access to healthy ecosystems to play, learn, work, worship, and live is a public health issue, as Zenobia pointed out about the health disparities in Oakland. And it's also a human right, but especially for children who are an environmental justice community or environmental justice population. They are vulnerable and they're sensitive. There are documented public health benefits to access to the outdoors. Without those opportunities, health disparities are clearly apparent. Now, I grew up in Atlantic City, New Jersey, at a time where there was still de facto segregation, and there were only Atlantic City is an island. How many people have been there? Okay, so a few people. This is before gambling, and I grew up. There's actually a great book that I discovered recently called "Growing Up in the Other Atlantic City." And it was by an African-American woman who really talked about what it was like growing up in the black north side of Atlantic City. And it's a fabulous little book. But at any rate, there was de facto segregation still in Atlantic City. And in an island, there were only two beaches that black people could go to. All right. Access to open space is an environmental justice issue. It's an environmental justice issue because there's a public health dimension to it, and if you are denied access to the salutary effects of being outdoors, then health disparities will become clearly apparent in the years ahead. And as Zenobia pointed out, people are leaving, are living, you know, a decade less. I mean, these are significant figures. Excuse me. So if all children need learning and health-enhancing time, both structured and unstructured, in the outdoors, we have to understand also that options for outdoor experiences are not equally distributed among children. This is a really important point, because reading the literature of Inside, No Child Left Inside, one could begin to think that, you know, all children are really the same. You know, it's like it totalizes childhood. But in fact, not all children have the same opportunities to get outside. When you're talking about populations in Oakland or Richmond or other places, urban populations, these children, there's no public transportation. How are they supposed to get to some of the same public land that they own, Golden Gate National Recreation Area? I personally introduced thousands of children for the first time experiences at Golden Gate National Recreation Area and other parks along the coast who had never been there before, who had not been able to get there unless we were able to carpool and to rent vans and buses. That being said, from a critical point of view about No Child Left Inside, I want to say that No Child Left Inside actually has deep personal relevance to me. It resonates deeply to me because my own efforts as a child, a teen, and a young adult to get and stay outside eventually turned into a career in outdoor and environmental education and now into environmental protection as well. So my trajectory has, my personal trajectory has verified one of the main tenets of the Leave No Child Inside movement, and that is that a child would be led to protect what he or she loves, and that love is spurred by full body and mind, unmediated experience in the outdoors. So that pattern really truly worked for me. Having succeeded at my career aspirations of being in the field of environmental education, I found a mission within the mission early on, and that was to make access to the natural world more relevant and accessible to children and families of color. So with Three Circles, which I talked about a little bit about before, there was a natural progression for us from working directly with students in the field to then working with teachers and training teachers about cultural competence and other ways of working effectively with students of color and recent immigrant children and so on. So there's, but despite the personal resonance, you know, I'm very conflicted about No Child Left Inside as with environmental education because as an outgrowth of, No Child Left Inside is an outgrowth of the mainstream environmental movement. And that discourse does not resonate with me very warmly as a person of color and an educator of color. And this is why. I think the discourse would be more relevant to a broader and deeper range of cultural, racial, and class experiences if it were contextualized, if environmental educators and outdoor educators themselves had unmediated experiences with the cultures and the communities you know, that they live within. They need that experience as well. So we can all agree that outdoor opportunities for children should be expanded. The impediments to those opportunities are not distributed equally. We have environmental justice groups that are working on transportation justice, for instance. You know, they can't even get to a supermarket. Food justice, I mean, it's all there. But we add to it going out to parks and so on. And actually, I want to mention Robert Garcia's work down in Los Angeles. Has anybody heard of his work, The City Project? Go right to the website, The City Project in LA, because he has documented in his organization, he works with grassroots, he's documented the location of parks, the locations of low-income people, locations of people of color, and we can see that there's a disparity in even local parks in the LA area. So that the center of the Leaving No Child Inside of that discourse, there is a social, economic, and cultural inequality that discourse does not really touch on in any kind of notable way. And that's very disturbing to me. The other part of the equation is that with the demographic changes in the country, it's clear that wild places are going to need constituencies that are comprised of populations that are historically and currently marginalized. The future of the environmental movement and the future of many aspects of our society are really in the hands of the demographic shift that is occurring. Children of color, get them out there. They may love it in their own way. We don't know what kind of environmentalists they will be or if they will be environmentalists. Okay, but it's clear that the constituencies for the places that we love that bring us all together are really in their hands. And their impressions of it and their love of it is really in our hands. That's, I think, an important point. Just a couple more points. So the fourth point about what No Child Left Inside means to me is that it seems a lot about access, but access is really a first step in the whole story here. In structured experiences outdoors, there's a dimension of cultural authenticity that is necessary for children of color to relate to and imagine a future in the outdoors. And that's definitely what Lorette was talking about, where they can imagine their future in the outdoors. And a final dimension to the issue of reaching students is one of vision. And there has to be a vision that is broader than the vision that the No Child Left Inside movement posits at the moment. To me, it seems it seemed like the vision of No Child Left Inside was sort of stuck in the past. It was I won't mention names in books, but it seems to me that it's like our vision is, as part of this movement, we want to create new environmentalists. And the fact is, we don't know, really, what kind of identity as environmentalists, quote unquote, these students will actually have. Because as the research shows, conditions for kids are really different now, and conditions for kids of color and low-income kids are profoundly, profoundly outside of the historical record. So, talking about transformation, there are lots of stories of transformation. Zenobia and Lorette had them, and environmental education organizations of all kinds have, students come to our program and they're transformed. But I want to also mention that it's not just the students that can experience transformation and be transformed. It's also educators need to be transformed. Mm-hmm. Programs need to be transformed. Okay? And if they're not, somebody said to me in a really low moment in my work many years ago, stop complaining. If your work is not changing you, it's not changing anybody else either. Okay? And so I see programs, again, access, right? And students are coming out to the programs, they're having these transformative experiences, they're there, and they send them home. And I'm saying that when I evaluate programs, I ask, what did your program learn? What happened to your educators? What did they get out of that experience of working with the students that they worked with? So I think finally that programs should ask themselves, how do we keep and even deepen the engagement of children and their families after they leave our program site? Once they're gone, how do we deepen that and maintain that? And how can we weave a beloved community from the contact we have with students visiting our program site for just a few days? It is the 60th anniversary of Brown versus the Board of Education. What does that mean to No Child Left Inside? That's what we should be asking ourselves. This is civil rights work. We are breaking down segregation in access to the environment, to the natural world. That's really, I feel, and Three Circles feels, that is the project that we're in. So finally, I just want to say that No Child Left Inside needs to be broad and deep enough not merely to create coalitions, but to understand how the educational concerns and the health concerns of low-income and communities of color are central to its own goals of creating access to natural areas from urban parks to the wildest of places. I think I use my time.
I have both the benefit and the drawback of going last. And amazingly, a lot of the great points that I would love to make have been made by a lot of my colleagues, which is fantastic. So therefore, I hope to be shorter than a lot of my colleagues because they had said so many powerful things. So again, my name is Nicole Ardwin. I work at Stanford University. I have a joint appointment in the Graduate School of Education and the Woods Institute for the Environment. I think that what I might do is just talk a little bit about what our group does and then maybe touch on a few points that some of my colleagues have made here, which I thought were really powerful. And in particular, some of the provocative points that Running Grass just made, I also was going to make, and I was a little anxious about making them, so I appreciate that he paved the way. Thank you. So I work with a group. Our group is called the Social Ecology Lab, and our team at Stanford works on environmental learning and stewardship and conservation behaviors, and we're really interested in looking at the nexus of those two. And in particular, we're interested in how connection with place motivates or doesn't motivate people to be engaged in stewardship and conservation behavior. And one of the areas that we're interested in looking at and we think a lot about is that without direct and personal connection to place, this work wouldn't be possible. And I like to think about place as one of those equal opportunity research topics. So I love this because every time you go anywhere and you tell people that you study place, somebody has something to say about it. So I think this gets to part of what Running Russ was just talking about. It is, I think, an environmental justice issue because everybody everywhere around the world has a personal connection with a place, whether it's their place or someone else's place or a place that's personally meaningful or a positive connection to a place or a negative connection to a place, everybody has something to say about a place. And that's what I love about studying place and places. I think they're very meaningful and they're very deep, and it's an affective way to study something. It's not always in the head, it's often in the heart, and I think that makes it a really important thing to think about. We also think about place both in terms of ordinary settings, so everyday settings. We think about kids going to school, we think about people going to work, we think about you doing perhaps what you're doing right now, sitting and listening and talking with friends and family. We also think about place in terms of extraordinary settings. So we do work on people going to parks, which for some people might be part of your ordinary, if that's where you work. But people going to places like Yosemite or Yellowstone or going on vacation, going to museums or zoos and aquariums. So we think about that range from the ordinary to the extraordinary. And people having unusual and punctuated opportunities to learn about the environment in the course of their everyday lives. So we're very interested in uncovering and understanding where these kind of transformative opportunities for learning about place and for learning about the environment occur, and also where these transformative opportunities for being motivated to take some kind of stewardship behavior might occur. We work with a number of organizations, some of which are sitting here in this room, and I always feel very honored to be able to work with colleagues to think about what are the most challenging things that are vexing you in your practice. And I mentioned to some colleagues earlier today that I often think of myself not so much as a researcher, but really as a practitioner, because I like to draw the research questions that we pursue from practice, because that to me means that they're really grounded in what's happening in the real world. I don't like to think of research as being in an ivory tower. And that helps us build the research base behind what we do. And then we connect those experiences back to prior research. So, for example, the developmental processes, and we're thinking about, you know, what does No Child Left Inside mean? It's really thinking about what are the benefits of getting outside, what are the benefits of connecting to nature, not only for kids, but also for adults. So a lot of the benefits of outdoor time and spending time in nature are really challenging to document. And this gets to one of the other elements of the work that we do, which is we do a lot of evaluation work. And I appreciate what Lorette was saying earlier. I was actually kind of busily scribbling some notes on one of these pieces of paper, one of the many that I had here. She was talking about that some of the outcomes of their work is that they galvanize community, they empower teachers and kids, they help endangered species, they create teamwork and passion and engagement. These are all things that are really hard to put numbers on. In fact, they're things that you were mentioning, you know, a scale of 1 to 5 maybe, and you get some one, you know, 1, 1, and a lot of 5s. But that's really hard to make that a compelling case, especially when you're trying to talk to funders or you're trying to send that back into the government. And those are the kinds of things that our team spends a lot of time thinking about. How do you make those things meaningful? How do you translate that magic back into something where you can turn around to someone and tell someone what your program actually does? So they aren't easy to document in what we think of as quantitative metrics. They can also take a long time to accrue. As we see in well-known, documented, and often cited body of work, what we call in the environmental education field, this body of work called significant life experiences, people often look back on significant life experiences 10 or 20 or 30 years later and say, that was really significant. That's something that changed my life. But you often don't know until 20 or 30 years later that that was something that changed your life, unless it's something like the birth of a child or a wedding or something you know, perhaps like a death of a parent. You might know at the time that that was something that was really important. But otherwise, it's often something that's fleeting in the moment, and later you look back and realize that was significant. So you can imagine as a researcher or as someone who's developing and designing a program, it's really hard to know at the time that that was something that was going to really galvanize your connection with the environment or change the way that you behave with regard to conservation. It's also really challenging to think about doing evaluation or doing research around these kind of narratives. So a number of my colleagues here tonight talked about stories and told these beautiful stories that were really compelling. And yet stories in and of themselves aren't necessarily research. You know, it's very hard to take these anecdotes and then compile them into meaningful and documented research. And so as researchers, we think about, you know, how do we take those stories and put them into a box or put them into some kind of way that's really systematic, which is how we turn these stories or anecdotes into qualitative data, which is different. So this is the kind of work that our group thinks about. We try to think about creative ways to really document this field-based magic. Another thing I'd like to mention that our team spends a lot of time kind of vexing over when we try to think about these incredible outdoor experiences and how to turn them into conservation behavior that motivates people over the longer term is that many people perceive environmental education to be just for kids or something that just happens once in a while. And really, it's lifelong and life-wide learning. And I'm actually going to quote one of my favorite quotes about environmental education comes from a colleague who's sitting at the table here, Zenobia. She said this when we were on a panel actually doing a workshop together a couple of years ago at the Environmental Grantmakers Association conference. And she said, environmental education isn't something that you do once in fifth grade or at summer camp. Otherwise, you'll end up with really outdated solutions to constantly changing problems. I love that quote, Zenobia. And I think it's really important to remember that if you just do it once and the world continues to change, so think about issues like climate change or toxic chemicals or many of these pressing challenges we have today, and you only did environmental education once, that one great time that you got to go to that one fabulous program, it doesn't prepare you to continuously make good decisions. The other part of that equation is that children don't exist in a universe all alone. I have a 6-year-old, and I tell you that my life is constantly revolving around taking her to activities or constantly revolving around figuring out what she's going to do with her friends or where she's going to be on the weekend or taking her to a beach cleanup or shaping her little mind in many different ways. And so these children don't just exist on their own. They're not only shaped by their teachers. They're not only shaped by their parents and grandparents and friends. These children exist in an ecology of a community. And so they're, you know, we often just only talk about parents or teachers, but there are neighbors, there are scout leaders, there are people in your neighborhood, there are many, many other adults. So this is when we think about communities, we think about outdoor time, we think about environmental education. This is about community members. It goes back to saying it takes a village, and it really truly does. We think about doctors, business people, policymakers, city planners, people who work in parks and rec department have a huge influence on the lives of these children. So we're all part of this conversation. I had so many notes here that I could jump to from what other people have said, but two other points I'd like to make, and then I would love to go to a conversation here. One is that it really struck a chord with me when Running Grass was talking about kind of some of the challenges around environmental justice issues, and I think about this a lot, in particular with a lot of the populations with which we work in some of the studies that we're currently doing, and also just, you know, I live in an urban area. I live in an apartment with a back deck, and I don't have a backyard, and yet we do a lot of gardening in a tiny little box. And I think a lot about the importance, particularly as our world changes from more urban to a more urban world, from a more suburban and rural areas. I think about the importance of fostering even the smallest of green spaces within urban areas and the opportunity to really connect people with the outdoors and with nature in these tiny green spaces. And certainly the field of environmental education has had times when we've been better at this and times when we've been worse at this. I look back at some of the founding documents in environmental education. The Tbilisi Declaration, which was written and signed in 1977, actually has some really powerful language around thinking about these equity issues and thinking about how do we do environmental education in urban areas. And yet I think we forget those touch points. I think about people like Bill Stapp, who was working back with the Global Rivers Environmental Education Network back in the 70s and 60s, and who was trying to do work around, you know, water quality and toxic chemicals in urban areas. I think about my colleagues who work with school gardens and urban gardens, and I think that there are some good models, and yet I think we often forget, and we think it has to only be far away from urban areas. We think it has to only be these kind of large, expansive areas in Yosemite or Yellowstone or the Grand Canyon. I think we forget that there's something really exciting about working in these small patches and working in thinking about pressing environmental issues that are much closer to home. So I couldn't agree more with some of these challenges and some of these incredible opportunities that are occurring closer to home. One last piece I just wanted to mention too is that, you know, kids really are incredibly resilient when we think about the opportunities that they make for themselves in spending time outdoors and spending time with each other and learning from each other in these really exciting opportunities. So I go back to some of the earlier comments I had about spending time in these, you know, open spaces where they can negotiate with each other. And I think that this does go also to thinking about these urban areas where they perhaps do have some more freedom. And in the urban areas, I think they're often more closed-in spaces where they don't have the freedom to run for acres and acres or miles and miles. And yet parents are closer by, neighbors are closer by. There is a bit of a more confined space. And yet, you know, children, when you're a child, you don't need 100,000 acres to be able to run across. You could in a half an acre lot. There's so many incredible opportunities, and kids have the chance for this free play, for some maybe more times to be able to explore their own interests and be able to work out what their interests are and really follow those kind of guided free play opportunities that we don't give them as many chances to do now, where everything is so structured. So I think that we can take opportunities where we find them. And I just, you know, that's what we found in some of our research. So I'd like to really emphasize that.
This is Ann Clark, and you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California Radio and our program, No Child Left Inside. Our panelists tonight have given us such rich discussions and information that we're going to change the program just a little bit. And that is, we're going to ask our moderator, Mitch Tomasheau, to ask a question to each of the panelists for them to answer, so that we will hear from each of them about a question that Mitch has decided would be a wonderful question for us all to ask. So if you are interested in hearing all of these answers, please stay. And we're welcoming Mitch. What's your question for each of the panelists?
Thank you. And I'm going to ask a question that is really for everybody here. And I hope that some of you stick around to have a discussion with us about these things informally. We'd all be very much like to have that opportunity with you. And I'm going to ask the same question to each panelist, but I'm going to ask you all individually for the benefits of the listening audience. And Anne asked me to ask a question that would generate a simpler response. So, of course, I'm going to ask you a complex question, but I hope it generates a fairly quick and rapid response. I have to tell a very quick little story. I had a wonderful opportunity yesterday to spend the afternoon with a good friend who works with the Union of Concerned Scientists and talks about how difficult it is on a daily basis to listen to and hear about and study the challenges we face in terms of the future of the climate and the many planetary emergencies that are on top of us. And we talked about that at some length. And I would like to ask each of you, because you all live with this all the time, among the other issues that you encounter, what for you, as simply stated as possible, and I'll start with Nicole Duan from Stanford, what for you best generates hope in your work?
The fact that I work in environmental education on environmental behavior, and it's because I see humans as incredibly resilient species, and so that is what keeps me getting up in the morning. So I work with people who study climate change. I work with people who study incredibly pressing and depressing environmental issues. And so the fact that I get to work with people who are working on solving and addressing issues in really positive, profound ways is what gets me up in the morning and keeps me positive and excited about this work.
Thank you, Nicole. And Running Grass of Three Circles.
I think what brings me hope in my work is that I believe in young people. and I believe in the vibrant communities that they come from. And I'm low-income and people of color communities are often viewed as, in terms of their, quote, their deficits, unquote. But actually, they are rich, rich in public service, rich in information, rich in experience in their own lives. And the articulate way that I have seen people speak who are quote, not supposed to be able to speak about these sort of things, or, quote, don't have the education to really be able to come to the Commonwealth Club, and participate in a discussion. I see really incredible intelligence in these communities and in these young people, and that brings me a lot of hope.
Lorette Rogers, Stork Creek Restoration Project.
So what brings me hope is that our organization, Point Blue Conservation Science, is focused on climate change, all our research and education, and that in the Straw Project, we're able to engage with students and their parents and their teachers to learn more about climate change, to look at it in an unblinking way, and then go ahead and plant those trees and change our restoration techniques to blunt maybe the bad effects of climate change. That gives me hope.
Thank you. And Zenobia Barlow of the Center for Ecological Literacy.
Well, what gives me hope is just merely being in the present moment in the natural world for the, I guess, maybe 12th year in a row. Hooded orioles have made nests in my backyard, and they've taken the fiber from the fan palm and built the most ingenious nest in the fold of the banana leaf that happens to be positioned right outside my back deck. So it doesn't take much of experiencing that to be re-energized.
And I'd like to say that what gives me hope is people like this. And I want to tell you that there are tens of thousands of folks like this, men and women of all ages, from all different kinds of groups, who are doing this kind of work. I've visited over 35 colleges and universities in the last couple of years doing consulting and giving talks related to sustainability, and I've encountered all kinds of magnificent people who care about community and want to make a difference in their world, and that generates enormous hope for me. Thanks so much, everyone. We'll stick around for any other thoughts you might have after we get a class.
This is Ann Clark, and this is the Commonwealth Club of California, and our program tonight is No Child Left Inside. We want to thank our moderator, Mitch Tomaszewski, for his wonderful moderation and for his hope, also for all the hopes from our speakers tonight. This has really been, I think, one of the most fascinating panel presentations and explorations of the issues that we are all, I think, in the room working with and dreaming about and hoping for. And so it's really my pleasure to bring this meeting of the Commonwealth Club to an end. Our thanks to Kevin O'Malley, Chair of the Business and Leadership Member-Led Forum, for co-sponsoring tonight's program on children and the environment. And don't forget our upcoming events, June 3rd, Secrets of the Treasure Island, the Navy's Radioactive Secrets, and on June 25th, college presidents and their national leadership for environment and sustainable actions. And many, many thanks to our wonderful audience here. This has been a special, special audience for me to listen to all that we've been able to hear and to have you with us. So our audience here on the radio and on the internet. I'm Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. This meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than 111 years of enlightened discussion in the know, is adjourned. So if everyone will stay seated for just a minute, we have our raffle.
Yes. You all were great. Thank you so much. That's fantastic. Everything
that we had. Okay, so I'm just going to have... how about Thomas, Mitch? You draw and give me.
Yeah.
We have six books.
The Karma of Contest.
The Karma of Contest.
Okay. Well, I need my glasses to read this.
Okay. Read the number.
Ticket. The first ticket is number 806627.
All right.
An outdoor educator.
Right.
That's right. There you go.
There you go. Thank you.
Okay.
All right.
Number two. I've never done this in all my years. I've never read raffle tickets before.
Never called bingo either.
806-584. Do we have a winner?
Yeah.
806-584. Well, maybe that person left. So here's another one. We may be here all night. 806-597. All right.
Okay, great.
I'm going to keep on doing it. I'm not going to wait for each person, all right? We're going
to
keep
this
going.
It's a trip to the Galapagos.
806-603. Anybody? 806-603. All right. Sorry. 806-600. All right. We have 600. You know, they're all 806s, so who's got 601? You got 601? But you're with him? All right, you can share. All right. 623. Okay. How many left are there?
Well, we have a whole bunch of buttons, but we got two more books.
All right, two more books.
And then we'll go fast on buttons.
629. Here we go. And finally... 599. Good to see you again. 599? No? Is that a bird who's got 599? 608? All right.
So let's do four buttons, and then if anyone wants a button after that, they can grab it from me.
Four buttons. I've got 615.
Oh, 608. That's from the bill.
I've got 610. Oh, if you want a button, just come and get one.
Yeah, just come and get. Right. So some of these say dream builders and some say tomorrow's leaders. So
first come, first serve.
Yeah. So thank you again, and don't forget to pick up the program on the film festival. And we look forward to your joining us for our programs, and look for us in the fall. Thank you.